I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump has belittled and demeaned Attorney General Jeff Sessions, one of his earliest and most ardent supporters, for recusing himself from the investigation into Russian meddling in the presidential election and possible collusion by the Trump campaign. Here's the president in the Rose Garden on Tuesday, responding to a reporter's question about his attacks on the Attorney General.
I am disappointed in the Attorney General. He should not have recused himself almost immediately after he took office. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me prior to taking office, and I would have quite simply picked somebody else. So I think that's a bad thing, not for the president, but for the presidency. I think it's unfair to the presidency, and that's the way I feel. Thank you.
South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham called Trump's campaign against Sessions a sign of great weakness on the part of the president. Ken Starr, who headed up the investigations into President Clinton, wrote in the Washington Post today, "Mr. President, please cut it out." Alabama Senator Richard Shelby defended Sessions on Fox News, also on Tuesday.
Jeff Sessions has been loyal to the president to a fault. He has been doing work for him, but Jeff Sessions is the Attorney General of the United States. He's not the president's personal lawyer, and I think that he's told him that, or led him to believe that, which is what he should do. I think Jeff Sessions is a man of principle, and he's going to stay there, and that's important.
The Washington Post has reported the president discussed a recess appointment of a new attorney general with his advisors and confidants, something the White House called fake news. Well, today on Radio Times, the campaign for and against Jeff Sessions. Jared Kushner's closed-door meetings with Congress this week, also policing White House leakers, and the debate to replace and repeal the Affordable Care Act in the U.S. Senate. And we have two guests who have joined us. Domenico Montanaro is lead editor for politics and digital audience at NPR. And Domenico Montanaro, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And also with us is Robert Costa, national politics reporter for The Washington Post. And Robert, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to join you.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Trying to get inside the president's head, Domenico, why doesn't he or why hasn't he fired Jeff Sessions?
I think it's always a perilous course to try to get inside the president's head, so I'll stay away from that. I'm not sure why he hasn't fired Jeff Sessions, but there's a couple ways to think about this. You know, it's what does he do next, right? Like the dominoes that would fall after this, he's kind of boxed in. You've had a lot of people on Capitol Hill, including Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, saying that he wouldn't even vote to confirm a new attorney general if Trump were to fire Sessions. Sessions has a lot of backup in the conservative media, among conservatives as well, because they understand that the scope of the Justice Department and the job of the Attorney General is not limited to the Russia investigation. You know, Trump and his allies keep acting like Jeff Sessions' only job has to do with the Russia investigation, because they keep saying, well, now he's recused himself, what was the point of putting him there?
Right.
Well, there's a lot more to the job at the Justice Department, including immigration, the travel ban, a whole host of issues that Jeff Sessions' Justice Department is working on, and that, frankly, the conservative base likes and sees him as an ally.
Well, Robert, how risky is this, or has this been for the president? As I said in my introduction, and it was very clear that Senator Jeff Sessions, one of the most ardent supporters of the candidate Trump, and also, I would say, one of the most active members of his administration. What's he got against this guy? Is it just about recusal?
Well, Marty, there are two main challenges for the president right now as he continues to fume in private. And my sources inside of the West Wing tell me they're trying to make the case to him that firing a law enforcement officer, another one, after going after then-FBI Director James Comey, will have sweeping consequences for his presidency. It would maybe lead to the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein becoming the acting Attorney General, and the president said he's not exactly a fan of Rosenstein. At the same time, you have the Senate Judiciary Committee saying, in the form of Chairman Chuck Grassley of Iowa, that he has no time for the rest of the year to consider another appointee for Attorney General. And you have, as you said, Marty, the political cost. Attorney General Sessions, when he was a senator and even now as Attorney General, was a hero to the Breitbart wing of the Republican Party, and that is the core of the Trump base.
I'm looking at an article, actually, Robert, you co-wrote back on June 6th, Sessions offers in recent months to resign as Attorney General. So in a sense, we have been here before. Apparently, the president did not accept his resignation, but this is not, I guess, something new.
It's not new. You have to take this back to early March when Attorney General Sessions made the decision to recuse himself from the Russia investigation at the Justice Department. And I reported the following day the president was yelling at his advisors inside of the Oval Office, saying, why is Sessions doing this? He shouldn't be allowed to do this. The president, I'm told, felt vulnerable, that he wanted an ally at the Justice Department as all of these probes unfold. He didn't want just some functionary or just some attorney general who he didn't really have a connection with. He wanted one of his guys at the top of the Justice Department as all this moved forward in terms of the investigation. And Sessions, knowing the president was furious, did offer to resign at numerous points. But he has made clear in recent days, there's an important distinction here, while he has offered to resign, he has also said he will not quit, and that he's put the president in the position in the last couple weeks. He has to be fired. He's not just going to walk away.
Well, let me go back to you, Domenico, and it is interesting to hear all the Republicans and conservatives standing up for Jeff Sessions. How much of a problem has he made for himself within his own party, he, of course, being the president?
Well, you know, this president wants to get some legislative achievements accomplished, and so far they haven't been able to. You know, this healthcare bill at least still continues on. You're going to see this potential vote today on the skinny repeal, as they call it, having to do with repealing mandates within the Affordable Care Act and the employer-based penalties if a company with more than 50 people doesn't if they don't provide health insurance to their employees. But every Republican on Capitol Hill basically views this bill as just something that's a vehicle to try to get to keep the conversation alive, so to speak. So this president, you know, with all of this focus that he's keeping on the Russia investigation and on Jeff Sessions and this drama that's going on, it is distracting from the other piece of major legislation that he would actually like to get accomplished. And right now it has a big feel of chaos and turmoil, and that there doesn't appear to be a strategy for getting any of this accomplished, you know, and including letting Jeff Sessions sort of twist in the wind.
Robert, is revolt too strong a word in describing at least some of the pushback we are hearing from some of these Republicans?
I'm careful in response here because I'm not sure there's going to be a full-scale revolt on the right. I've covered the movement right for nearly a decade.
Right.
And in the inner circle of the leadership of that Breitbart wing, the populist nationalist Steve Bannon wing, Jeff Sessions is revered. However, he is a low-key public figure. This is not someone who's on television often. He's not a well-known personality in the same way other people in this administration are. So you'll have some of the leadership in that wing of the Republican Party, very unhappy with the president. I connected with Ann Coulter this week, the Firebrand commentator. She said she'd be very angry with the president if he let go of Sessions. She doesn't like the tensions right now. But the mainstream Republican Party, the main part of the Trump base, I'm not sure they're paying as close attention. The president, as you saw in his rally this week in Youngstown, Ohio, still has quite a hold himself over his voters. It's not just because of the attorney general.
Robert, I mean, clearly this is the president's campaign against the attorney general. Are there other people in the White House who are in support of the president in going after Sessions?
You have an echo chamber inside of this White House where there are many aides and advisors and confidants and people who the president talks to, whether they're employed by him or not, and they seem to channel the president and say, well, if you're unhappy with the attorney general, we get that. We want to support you in that. And you see people like the new communications director, Anthony Scaramucci. He's really been channeling the president publicly, saying Attorney General Sessions could be on the chopping block. He could be on his way out, not defending the AG at all in all of his television interviews, really being a spokesman for the president's fury rather than trying to settle the situation or calm the nerves.
Domenico, and again, perhaps I'm asking you to get inside the head of the president again, and I apologize for that. But in trying to understand what he is doing, is it to get at Mueller or get at the decision to hire Mueller to investigate the Russia collusion or meddling in the campaign?
Well, he's clearly annoyed with what's going on with the Russia investigation. He's tired of the drip, drip, drip. He doesn't want to see the leaks that have continued. The White House, I'm told, was actually pretty happy yesterday that the transgender story was the focus of a lot of cable news rather than Russia still, which is really
Was that by
something.
Design? Was that by design, do you think?
I don't think it's by design to change a story for one day, but I think they were pleased that that was the outcome. You know, I think that some of the White House insiders who I'd seen quoted believed that this was a raw political, that there was at least a raw political advantage to what this ban does. They think that when you think about blue-collar voters in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, that those blue-collar whites would be supportive of this and that they're happy to see the left get upset about it. Now, I don't think they expected the backlash that they got from their own party on this, and it seems that it went a step further than what even congressional Republicans were looking for. Congressional Republicans, some of them who are lobbying on this, just wanted to be able to say that the Pentagon wouldn't have to pay, that taxpayers wouldn't have to pay for certain treatments and surgeries for transgender folks. So this went a step further by banning them, and a lot of people didn't have a heads up on that. So, you know, what he's doing with Jeff Sessions, you know, it's not completely clear, but obviously he is upset with what's happening with the Russia investigation. There is the thought that he would like to be able to have somebody who can kind of play a little blocking and tackling. I mean, if you listen to Anthony Scaramucci, who's the new communications director, he was on the conservative Hugh Hewitt show, the radio show, the other day, and said that Eric Holder was a good hockey goalie for President Obama. In other words, his job is to protect the president in some ways, and that's not really the job of the attorney general.
And that is Domenico Montanaro, lead editor for politics and digital audience at NPR. Also with us, Robert Costa, national politics reporter for the Washington Post, talking about the president and the attorney general. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and I'm talking with Robert Costa from The Washington Post, Domenico Montanaro from NPR, about the president's campaign against Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Also, there was a mention of the new White House communications director and, of course, what's going on in the Senate, the skinny repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act. And you can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, here's a tweet from Carrie. Can anyone tell me how Trump doesn't get that Sessions didn't know what was going to happen? Not a Sessions fans, but not a Sessions fan, Carrie says, but duh. A tweet from Paul, don't forget it was Al Franken's sharp questions that forced Sessions to recuse himself. Franken could whip Trump in 2020, and then he goes on from there. How much do you think, and I'll put this to you, Robert Costa, and there was actually a story about Jeff Sessions. This is coming from the Russian ambassador. It was an Intercept saying that he and Sessions did discuss some election-related matters. Now, I don't know whether the Russian ambassador's exaggerating their conversations or not, but where does that stand, or can you fill in any of that for us?
It's a difficult situation. You see that Sessions is trying to move forward with his agenda at the Justice Department. He is pursuing policies on law enforcement that are far more drastic than we saw with the Obama administration, in particular with regard to crimes along the U.S.-Mexico border. You see him going after sentencing policy in a hardline way. And so people close to the president tell me this is part of the problem they have in the case they're making for Sessions. As much as the president feels like he's out in the cold when it comes to the Russia investigation, there's no more loyal member of the cabinet or a cabinet official who's actually moving forward with Trump-style policies than Sessions. And so he would kind of gut that core of the Trump agenda if he went.
And Domenico, what is Scaramucci, what does he bring to either or both the White House and to the conversation?
With Scaramucci?
Yeah.
Scaramucci is somebody who at least has been on TV. He's a Trump guy. He's somebody who, you know, kind of fits the mold a little bit better than Sean Spicer, who had resigned, who was doing dual duty as press secretary and communications director. Sean Spicer is much more of a Washington character, you know, not someone you're going to see in slick suits or, you know, trying to, you know, be real smooth on TV. That's just not the way he operates. You know, he's a strategist. He's an operative. He's somebody who's been around campaigns for a long time and agencies in Washington. Scaramucci, on the other hand, somebody who has liked politics. He's raised a lot of money. He's a schmoozer. He's somebody who ran a hedge fund and a millionaire. And then you saw today with this story that came out in Politico that he believed was leaked and then sort of made this mistake by saying that it was leaked, even though it was apparently gotten by a public record.
About his finances, right? About his finances.
Correct. Yeah, about how he's still making about $5 million. He made about $5 million from Skybridge Capital this year. Skybridge Capital is the hedge fund that he started and that he sold off earlier this year. And he's still collecting some money from them. He was irritated with the leak of that disclosure, but it wasn't a leak. It was actually a reporter who did some old, you know, good old shoe leather reporting and got that through public records, which it is public record. So you have this White House that doesn't quite realize what is public record, what isn't public record. They're new to the scene. And then he made a mistake by saying, you know, pointing the finger at Reince Priebus, the White House chief of staff, and saying, well, if he wants to say he's not the leaker, let him say that. Well, you know, that just opens up the whole can of worms and contradicts the tone that he tried to set when he first stepped to the White House lectern and saying that he has no problem working for Reince Priebus or working with Reince Priebus. I offered him a job as COO of my hedge fund, and I think he should have taken it. So he tried to make it sound like everything was smooth and there were no problems, and now we see that that's just not true.
I mean, it should be said about Scaramucci that while he did profess his love for the president, he did not necessarily love the president not so long ago, Domenico.
Absolutely.
There's got that the whole kind of Twitter trail of critical comments he had about the president.
And not only that, but he was on TV in 2015 when he was backing Jeb Bush and then Marco Rubio, or vice versa, rather, where he said that he was irritated with Trump saying that hedge fund guys don't do much but push paper around and that they deserve to have their taxes raised. And that irritated Scaramucci to the point where he wound up playing a class issue in New York where he said, Trump is nothing but an inheritance dude from Queens County.
Ouch.
Kind it was an odd comment for a guy from Long Island to make, frankly, because he's not exactly a Manhattanite who might level that kind of, you know, class charge at Trump. But he knew it would get under Trump's skin, and he said that he's had to apologize 50 times for that to Trump, and apologized again at the briefing room the other day.
Robert, let me go back to you, and we've got some callers that want to join our conversation. You've covered White Houses before. Is this one leakier than, for instance, the Obama White House?
There are always leaks. I think what's flaring this situation is all the internecine warfare within the West Wing and all the claims about leaks and leaks against each other. Every White House has officials talking to reporters. This has just become officials talking to reporters plus all of the public drama about officials wondering who's trying to knife who in Politico or the New York Times or the Washington Post. I think it's a drama, though, that's become quite complicated and sometimes hard to follow. It's most notable today that Anthony Scaramucci has claimed he's been leaked against, as Domenico was saying.
Right.
And now it's been proven that these documents Politico published about Scaramucci's finances were public documents. And so it's just a muddied situation about what's actually a leak, what's just a reporter talking to an official, what's actually just disclosure of public documents.
And he has certainly threatened to fire people for leaking. I'm assuming that's part of his job as he sees it, Robert.
It is, though there's a real divide in this White House about who's actually leaking. We saw the resignation / firing of Michael Short, a lower-level press advisor this week. He was an ally of Chief of Staff Reince Priebus. Scaramucci edged him out of the White House. But some of my sources say maybe it's not actually the press shop that's leaking, as Scaramucci has asserted, but perhaps people in the agencies, different parts of the federal government. This idea that it's just the press shop in the White House that is causing the leaks, that is that's a debatable topic among my sources, to be sure.
And that's Robert Costa from The Washington Post, Domenico Montanaro from NPR. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. I see a bunch of comments coming in. Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Jackie from Lehigh Valley to join our conversation. Jackie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask Robert Costa, you've spoken about the language of conservatism before and trying to understand that. And I wanted to know if you thought that it's being used by Donald Trump to advance his agenda, and specifically as it relates to the healthcare issue, and sort of like if you take the transgender ban that he just came out with now on Twitter, which has been opposed by some very important Republicans very right. publicly. Is this part of sort of a sort of sign that Donald Trump's sort of idea of what the language of conservatism is at odds with what his Republican, you know, caucus
sure.
is seeing that as? And thank you so much.
You're welcome, Jackie. Call. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. An interesting question, Robert Costa, about the president's use of conservative language or conservative meanings, as Jackie describes. How do you see that?
It is an intriguing question, but my answer is not necessarily about the language of conservatism. I think that this decision by the president to, in effect, ban transgender people from serving in the military, it is actually a transactional moment for the president. It shows how he's a transactional person. My reporting bears out that House conservatives have said they will not pass a budget unless it's clear that transgender people will not be allowed in the military, that the House Freedom Caucus – and this has been reported out elsewhere too – if the House Freedom Caucus very briefly has said if that policy continues, they're not going to support the budget – so trying to get them on board for the budget, the president has come out with a statement about banning transgender people from the military. Mm. It's a transactional decision by the president, but it does make him wade into the culture wars in a way that he has not in the past. He's been less strident in his social conservatism, but it shows you that he's willing to go there if it means cutting a deal.
I mean, Domenico, it is policy by tweet now.
Yeah, policy by tweet, you know, is not what a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill would like to see. You heard, saw Lindsey Graham criticizing the president for that. And a lot of people at the Pentagon, some of our reporting here said that yesterday when the tweets came out, there was a gap between the first tweet and the second tweet. And a lot of people at the Pentagon were holding their breath to see what Trump was actually talking about or going to be announcing. And then when the transgender ban came out, they were sitting around in a conference room and someone looked at someone else and said, which one of the generals, which generals have been briefing Trump on this? And they all looked around and shrugged and said, we don't know. So this was a surprise to the Pentagon, which has to implement this policy. And it's, again, not the first time that something has come out of the White House, and wouldn't be surprising if it's because that they're so petrified of tweet of leaks coming out that the president winds up putting something out from himself, right, rather than going through the process of rolling something out in a deliberative way that's usually done in the government.
But are you saying that gap between the first and second tweet, people that were watching were thinking, uh-oh, something, what, we're going to war? I mean, I don't mean to overstate that, but
yeah, they didn't know. They didn't know exactly what they were going to be in for. They knew that it had to be something Pentagon related. You know, the Pentagon deals with the military, and they weren't sure where that was going. 9-minute gap there, and they weren't sure if there was something they didn't quite know that maybe somebody else had been briefed on, and then wind up seeing that it's a transgender ban, and some issued a little bit of a sigh of relief in some ways because they thought it could have been something more than that.
Wow. Let me get Bridget from Havertown to join us, and then we have a clip from Jared Kushner. Bridget, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I was just...
Whoops. Did we lose her? Well, Bridget had a question. Are we watching the fall of democracy? Do you see it that way, Robert Costa?
The fall of democracy?
She wants to know if we are watching the fall of democracy.
Well, as a reporter, I try to stray away from any kind of apocalyptic conclusion or dramatic statement. I think what we're witnessing here is a total outsider as president disrupt not only the norms of American politics, but the institutions inside and outside the government, the media, the agencies, the Congress, and it is chaos. And he is surrounding himself with more and more allies rather than people from within the establishment, further, in a sense, isolating himself from the people who would like to calm a lot of this situation. Whether it's the end of democracy or not, that's for other people to decide. But we are certainly witnessing history.
Witnessing history, and certainly a test, I would assume, Domenico, of our institutions. And we have been here before.
Unquestionably, I think you can look at this in two different ways. You know, you can look at it, one, as the caller does, wondering if it's the fall of democracy. I think it's overstating the case at this point, but I do think that the institutions of democracy are getting a stress test, unquestionably. And you could look at it from the other side of this, that these institutions are actually standing up and maintaining some balance, being able to say to the President of the United States, no, you can't do those things, because there's a process, there's a constitution, this is the way it works, this is how the Justice Department functions, this is how the rules are applied. So they are definitely getting stress tests right now, but I think the problem in the country is the kindling is there for disrupting these systems. When you look at polling, it shows that people have far less trust in institutions in this country that they used to believe in, they used to trust, including the Supreme Court, including the Justice Department, including the military. So when all of those things start to happen, it is possible for a leader who's seeking unlimited or less limited power to be able to convince a significant chunk of people in the country that they should listen to him rather than to believe in the status quo and those institutions.
Let me play another clip, and then we're going to have to say goodbye to the two of you in just a couple of minutes. And this is Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of the president, his confidant. He's giving a or gave a brief statement on Monday following his meeting with Senate investigators. Let's listen.
Let me be very clear. I did not collude with Russia, nor do I know of anyone else in the campaign who did so. I had no improper contacts. I have not relied on Russian funds for my businesses. And I have been fully transparent in providing all requested information. Donald Trump had a better message and ran a smarter campaign, and that is why he won. Suggesting otherwise ridicules those who voted for him.
We only have a couple of minutes, not enough time to do true justice to where things stand. The various investigations into Kushner and other members of the Trump campaign. Robert, where are things? And we're talking about a House investigation, a Senate, and of course the FBI.
Kushner had his moment on Capitol Hill, a private meeting with investigators as they go over his role in the campaign and Russian interference. What we're witnessing and what we're watching is congressional investigators trying to move forward, trying to collect information, bring more Trump associates to the Capitol. But the real story, the unanswered question, is what the special counsel Bob Mueller is going to do, whether he's pursuing financial crimes, the Trump family businesses, Kushner family businesses, whether it's just about a possible obstruction of justice with regard to the firing of Comey. No one really knows. So in the meantime, as we all wait for Mueller to proceed and make public what he's up to, Congress is just trying to piece together the puzzle, but they're not making significant progress because the special counsel is really the story.
And Domenico, 30 seconds, but interestingly, no leaks so far from the Mueller investigation.
Yeah, very few. You haven't seen a lot of leaks from Mueller. He's tried to keep mum on a lot of things, although conservatives are upset over the kinds of high-powered lawyers he's brought in who have had, some of them have had donations to Democratic candidates, although the Justice Department doesn't see those leaks as ethical, I mean the donations as ethical conflicts of interest.
On that note, Domenico Montanaro, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're welcome.
Lead editor for Politics and Digital Audience at NPR, Robert Costa, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. National politics reporter for The Washington Post. And after this very short break, we'll be talking about whether the U.S. president has the complete power to pardon. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. President Trump tweeted recently, "All agree the U.S. president has the complete power to pardon." He tweeted this after a story in the Washington Post about the president's lawyers discussing pardons in relation to the FBI investigation into whether the Trump campaign colluded with Russians. Now, Trump's lawyer, Jay Sekulow, downplayed the issue and said the power to pardon has never been adjudicated. Well, that led to the question, can a president pardon him or herself? And joining us is Claire Finkelstein. She's the Algernon Biddle Professor of Law, also professor of philosophy and director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. Claire, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Let me repeat the president again. All agree the U.S. president has the complete power to pardon. Do you agree?
No, unfortunately, I don't. It surprises me some of the commentary I've been hearing about this, so I'm glad to have the opportunity to set it straight. I keep hearing people saying, yeah, he has the power to pardon himself, but it wouldn't be a good idea because he'd have to admit to a crime. And in fact, both halves of that seem wrong to me. So let's start with the question of whether or not the president has the power to pardon himself.
Sure.
And I think the answer is unquestionably he does not. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution says that the The president has the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. So the question is, what does that mean? Let's first be clear. It has to be a federal crime that's at issue. That has been pretty clearly understood. So any state crimes for which the president might be charged or indicted, would his power of pardon would be irrelevant. What about the second half, except in cases of impeachment?
Right.
What could that possibly mean? Well, this is a constitutional phrase like any other constitutional phrase, like due process, like equal protection, like privileges and immunities, and it has to be interpreted. And in general, we interpret constitutional phrases against the background of the purpose for which they were written, as well as common sense. So common sense suggests that this phrase would be meaningless unless it meant that the president did not have the power to pardon for crimes that could lead to impeachment.
Well, let me stop you there, because I have a more sort of basic question. And is it about that you cannot be both the judge and the jury? I mean, is that also part of this question about whether a president has this absolute or complete power to pardon, and whether he could pardon or she could pardon him or herself? Is it that you can't sit in judgment of your own on your own guilt or innocence, I guess, your own guilt?
That's absolutely right. And this is connected with a larger value, which is also an important background for interpreting any constitutional phrase, which is the value of the rule of law. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that the president is not above the law, none of his officers is above the law. The president holds power according to a legal structure that determines the limits of his or her office. And if the president had the unfettered power to pardon himself, he would be, in effect, above the law.
Well, and does that get us into the heads of the founders, you know, the people that wrote the Constitution, their fear of a monarchy, or perhaps in more current language, a dictatorship?
That's correct. And so this pardon power, what it is meant to do, it's important to understand this, is to remove the punishment. It doesn't remove the conviction. That's very important. It's very comparable to a governor's power to grant clemency for someone who is, say, on death row. All that does is to say this person will not be put to death, but it doesn't actually take away the conviction, number one. And number two, it's very important to understand that the founders were concerned about making sure that the president exercised power within constitutional limits and according to a balance of powers in the federal government. So if the president had the power to pardon himself and to obstruct impeachment in that way, which could be the result, not necessarily, but it could be, then it would run counter to both, I think, the language and the spirit of this provision.
Well, interestingly, we have had presidents who have been impeached, Johnson and Clinton being the two. They did not pardon themselves. Does that tell us something?
Well, it does tell us something. This runs into another issue, of course, is whether or not a person has the ability to pardon themselves preemptively. Now, Clinton was not convicted of a crime, so technically you ought to only talk about pardons when there is an identifiable crime. But the second half of the common commentary that I've been hearing about this says that you have to wait until a person has been convicted of a crime in order to exercise a pardon. And that part is also not right, at least according to the precedent that we have. There was, a Civil War case, and this is really the only Supreme Court precedent that we have, which is ex parte Garland, which said that Confederate soldiers who had put down their arms could be pardoned even though they had not yet been convicted of a crime. This was obviously intended to bring Confederate soldiers back into the Union and to make them less afraid of putting down their arms and surrendering. That's the only Supreme Court precedent that we have, and it does look then as though there can be a preemptive pardon, but it is absolutely wrong to think that the president can pardon himself.
Let me quote something in more recent history. This goes back to 1974. This is a woman who was part of the investigation of Watergate. And this apparently was something she wrote 4 days before Nixon resigned. Under the fundamental rule that no one may be a judge in his own case, the president cannot pardon himself. Just to underscore what you were saying. So maybe while the Supreme Court hasn't ruled on this, there have been at least written commentary on it of people investigating abuses of power.
And we also have prior cases to look at. So, for example, let's talk about when President George H.W. Bush pardoned Caspar Weinberger, who was former defense secretary, with regard to the Iran-Contra affair. And that was thought to be a very questionable move on his part, because it really made it difficult to investigate the president's own potential involvement in that. So on the reading that I'm suggesting, it would not be permissible for the president to pardon himself, but it would also not be permissible for him to pardon other individuals, his vice president or his other individuals who are in his administration, if doing so would impede an impeachment, because they are also subject to impeachment. So, for example, it would not be permissible on this reading for him to pardon Jared Kushner,
his son-in-law.
That's right, because he is arguably a civil officer and therefore subject to impeachment under the Constitution. And so pardoning him would be an interference with the impeachment power.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from Randy, complete power to pardon, in quotations, if it means the power of the president to pardon himself could not have been envisioned as allowable or consistent with the principles of the Constitution, specifically the separation of powers. Does that underscore what you're saying?
Yes, that's exactly correct. Separation of powers, of course, in this case, doesn't mean ordinary legislation. So it's also quite clear, and the court in the Ex parte Garland case reinforced this, that Congress does not have the power to pass ordinary legislation to influence or limit the pardon power. But what they do have the power to do is impeach, and impeach not just the president, but to impeach civil officers. Now, that's been interpreted to mean fairly high officers. But the pardon power under this provision on Article 2, Section 2, must not interfere with congressional impeachment power. And that's where the separation of powers lies.
Can a president be indicted for crimes that predate his or her election?
Yes. And here, this is a very important topic these days, especially because of a memo that Charlie Savage unearthed through a Freedom of Information Act request. It is very clear, I think, that the president can be indicted not just for crimes that he may have committed prior to becoming president, but crimes that he may have committed during his presidency that are unrelated to his official duties. So the memo in question that Charlie Savage unearthed was written by the Office of Legal Counsel during the Clinton years, having to do with whether or not President Clinton could be indicted for crimes that he may have committed, either connected with Whitewater or connected with Monica Lewinsky and the sexual scandal.
In fact, let me quote it. This is from the Star Office memo. Yes, Charlie Savage in the New York Times. This is just a couple of days ago. This is what it said. Of course, going back to the 1990s, the Star Office memo says it is proper, constitutional, and legal for a federal grand jury to indict a sitting president for serious criminal acts that are not part of and are contrary to the president's official duties. In this country, no one, even President Clinton, is above the law. I mean, that's powerful language there.
That's right. And it makes a good deal of sense in terms of our constitutional values and the concept of the rule of law, because the president's immunity to prosecution is relative only to his role as president. So to the extent that he is acting outside of his official duties and acting in ways that are not authorized by his office, the law should not be protecting him, immunizing him from prosecution. His immunization comes from his presidential duties. It is not the person that's immunized from prosecution. It's the role. And that's what's critical to the rule of law.
Can we throw obstruction of justice in this? Sort of what we need to understand about that. And of course, presidents fire people. This president fired James Comey. And obviously, there's some questions about what's going to happen with Attorney General Sessions or maybe even Mueller. I don't want to get over my skis, so to speak. But how does the Constitution understand or write about obstruction of justice?
Well, the Constitution doesn't. So obstruction of justice is a federal crime. And so the question is whether or not the president can be understood as violating federal law in seeking to obstruct the investigation into his own possible wrongdoing and the wrongdoing of members of his family or associates by getting rid of anyone who's investigating these crimes.
Right.
And in my view, it makes out a very good case of obstruction of justice. Were he to fire Jeff Sessions in order to put an attorney general in place so that new attorney general would then fire Robert Mueller, that whole course of action looks like a very good case for obstruction of justice. If his thought then, according to the apparently rather poor legal advice that he must be getting from his lawyers, is that he can do that and then he can pardon himself and thus stay in office and avoid impeachment, he's made a number of legal mistakes that really would not serve him well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the attorney general. And I think that office, that position is misunderstood, it seems like, by the president, who seems to view Sessions as his own personal attorney. So on the one hand, the president gets to select who he or she wants to be the attorney general. But the attorney general doesn't really work for the president. Can you help us understand what this relationship is about?
That's right. It's very complicated, of course, because we have a single branch of government, but there are differentiated roles within that branch of government. So the attorney general, of course, is the highest law enforcement agent in the officer in the country. And it's been part of our tradition that the attorney general has a great deal of independence, and particularly independence from the president, for just exactly the reason that we are seeing playing out here. What's very difficult, and what I think the whole country is coming to grips with, is that so many of the aspects of the rule of law and the interstitial tissue that holds the rule of law in place have been more by tradition than by legal requirement. However, by having those traditions, they in effect become legal requirements because they help to interpret the legal provisions that we have. So in interpreting something like the pardon provision of the Constitution or in interpreting an obstruction of justice statute, we have to interpret that against the background of our legal and constitutional and rule of law values. And this independence between the Justice Department, relative independence between the Justice Department and the president, is part of what shores up those rule of law values.
So the attorney general, in a sense, works for us, works for the public, even though he was or she was selected by the president, or is our interpreter of the Constitution?
Well, to some extent of the Constitution, but most importantly, federal laws. So the Attorney General is the chief law enforcement officer for the country with regard to federal law. The Supreme Court is the ultimate arbiter of the Constitution and in some sense has review power over the Attorney General's interpretation of federal laws as well. But the Attorney General's role is really focused on interpreting federal laws and then enforcing those laws, and that's a very critical part. If there is no independence between the Attorney General's office and the presidency, then it becomes, and we're seeing the limits of this right now, very, very difficult in our system to have any check on the president other than the impeachment process.
And we're almost out of time here. It does feel as if our institutions are being tested, maybe not a bad thing from your perspective.
Yes, they are. And it's quite interesting, not to throw a monkey wrench in the discussion, but it's worth comparing our constitutional tradition and our treatment of the presidency to other countries like Brazil, where we've seen a lot of corruption in the presidency and now a lot of prosecution of sitting presidents, former presidents, and in some sense, Brazil is grappling with a lot of the same issues that we are, and it's a kind of worldwide lesson in what it means to have a president who serves under the law.
Claire Finkelstein, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. She's the director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. You can sign up for a newsletter and be part of our Radio Times family. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.